Welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Fossils by Firelight. This is the fourth in the series. And once again, we've got some of your geological heroes who will tell us some of their interesting stories over fire, an imaginary one. We've got three guests, youngsters, and everyone knows when I refer to someone who is older than me as a youngster, it's because they inspire me with their ambition, sometimes youthful exuberance. But we'll get onto that shortly, and Nolene will introduce them.
Our first guest today is James Campbell. He's Managing Director of Botswana Diamonds. He has also been MD for African Diamonds and then VP for New Business for Lucara Diamond Corporation after it acquired African Diamonds. James, tell us a bit about your time at De Beers.
Nolene, thank you very much indeed for having me. I think it's quite boring if one kind of rattles off a CV or something like that. And I'd just like to share something which comes back to where I'm working at the moment. So here I was sitting in the field in Zebediela in the late 1980s. And I just got married and we just fixed up the old farmhouse for my wife and I to kind of start our married life together. And I was told I was going to have a visit by every single Patterson band level at De Beers, going all the way up to the managing director. And the managing director, I think, had a grade of G something, G standing for God. and I was C something. So I was very, very far below. And of course, there were multiple levels in between it. And I was incredibly enthusiastic because I was a diamond explorer for De Beers. That's what I was being paid to do. And unlike many of my other colleagues who were working in the area, we were finding diamonds and we were finding diamonds in abundance. So I was scooping out cores of diamonds from the jigs. And I thought this was tremendously exciting and I thought we ought to do something about this. So I gave this presentation out to this large grouping of people. And my wife was kind of getting a bit worried because she had served a fresh fruit juice from the Zebediela citrus estates. And I know my boss, Bill McKechnie, liked beer instead of fruit juice. So anyway, I did the fruit juice thing. Then there was a hushed silence at the end, deathly silence. And the managing director said to me, "Young man, let's go and have a chat outside." And I nearly wet myself. I thought, oh my God, what's going to happen here? So he took me outside and put his arm around me and said to me, "Young man, when you grow up, I think you'll understand the things I'm about to tell you." And I kind of cringed. He said, "We don't want you to find anything." And I said to him, "But I'm a diamond explorer. Surely you want me to find things." He said, no, it's not quite as simple as that. And I said, you want us to find things, but not let others have them. And he said, that sounds about right. Anyway, this is all far too small, and we're going to send you off to find the source of the Western Transvaal alluvials. So we packed our bags and off we went. And the final part of the story here comes 10 years later, where I'm a bit more senior now. I think I'd got to the D band by then. And I was a technical assistant at the head office, and someone comes banging at my door at 6 a.m. "Southern Era have found Maasfontein." "Oh," I said, "really?" He said, "Wasn't that your project?" And I said, "Yes." "Well, you better get onto it and see if we can't get our interest back." So it was a fascinating kind of introduction to diamond exploration, diamond geology, and kind of working. And I was very, very fortunate to spend over 20 years with De Beers. And now I've spent almost the last 20 years running junior companies.
As you can hear, James is a phenomenal speaker. And him and I tend to be on the same conference circuit. Quite often I talk after him, and I always dread it.
All right. On to our second guest. And similar to yourself and James, Nolene, I run into him at various events. The last one was actually a South African Institute of Environmental and Engineering Geology, SAIEG, where they were celebrating their 40th year. And our next guest, his company was celebrating its 40th year as well. And it's none other than Mr. Oliver Barker, whom I referred to as Uom Oli at times, or Malume, who's a director at Manzi Geotechnics, which was previously Barker and Associates. very well known for what he calls books on the walls, the very invaluable maps, coal fields of Southern Africa, platinum in Southern Africa, gold fields of Southern Africa. I'm sure a lot of people have seen those. Ollie, you mentioned you started off being a driller. Can you tell us a bit about those days and then how that led you into the exploration days?
Well, you know, in our day, which we were very fortunate, we had to get through practical work to get our degree, actually. So when you were at university at Wits anyway, you had to have shown that you had practical work done. And I did a couple of things. I worked in Namibia on the West Coast. And then I also got a job with Boughton Hard Metals drilling for two situations. One was the plant for the titanium magnetite projects on the western, the eastern limb, that famous mine where they stripped off all the land and produced the most extraordinary impact that you can imagine, which resulted in dams being polluted and filled with waste within half the life that they'd planned. And then also for the dam that they were going to build to provide water to that project. And we were sent out, I was the driller, the boss. And I, as a student in my, going into my third year, I think, or yeah, it would have been my third year. And I was given a little rig, a 6-horsepower, I think, Briggs & Stratton engine, driving a little spindled BX core barrel and a little rig. And we had to push it around on a wheelbarrow. And I worked for 3 months like that, learning how to drill in quite very primitive conditions. And it gave me an insight into the other side of geology, which us geologists very often don't experience, because we go in there, we look at the core, we tell the driller what to do if we are in that position, and we record the data that is coming out. And we are very esoteric very often. The driller doesn't understand what we're talking about. And as a result, it has given me a much better insight into that less erudite part of geology. And I'm doing it right now. We have a project on the West Rand, and we're drilling, and we had endless problems for the first hole. And I'd spent a lot of time trying to explain to my young geologist from KZN, just joined me, how he must face these issues, because it wasn't going to be straightforward. We're getting 30% and less of core recovery for a hole when you're trying to make sure that we know all the stratigraphy is not a good thing. So yeah, that was my background as a young student, but not thereafter.
All right. And one thing I need to mention is the past president of the SIAEC, as mentioned, and you've got experience in environmental exploration and engineering geology as well. How did you now move on into those disciplines, exploration, and how were those days essentially?
Survival. I came out, I was lucky to get a job with under Derek Kyle in the early 70s, and then, of course, 72, the world came to an end, and he found me underneath my car at lunchtime fixing something up, and he said to me, "Oliver, I think it's time that you went to university again," which I'd been preparing for, because I'd mapped the whole of the Soutwansberg for one of my projects. And I said, "Okay, thank you, Derek," and off I went. And that, I then had to go and find some money. And then I did my master's research. I ended up with 3 supervisors, because the one supervisor banked, didn't perform. And that then sort of set me in a trend of self-reliance and, you know, survival, because working for yourself in an industry in those days, which was so focused on the big corporates, they had their consulting divisions. They didn't hand out work like the companies in America do at that stage. You know, you didn't have consultants who would go in. The SRKs of this world were starting to get into the world, but they were also quite big by that stage. And 3 partners made a big difference to 1. And I started around about the same time. But, you know, it was a situation where you you had to work with the fluctuations. The industry kept going up and down. So I started as an exploration geologist, and I did a lot of copper work out of my thesis for Billiton, Anglo and a number of other companies, including Rio Tinto. And then things came to an end, and there was no exploration work. And I met Tim Partridge, who worked with Tony Brink, two of the luminaries of engineering geology, and they offered me a job. And so I started doing engineering geology. I went down the first trial hole, which was about 30 meters deep on the East Rand. I remember Tony standing at the top there with his cigarette box, with a, in those days, silver one, and he was pointing the light down, and he, "Can you see the soil at the bottom of that hole?" So, yeah, and then I can carry on after that. But that was how I got into engineering geology. And then I've always been, holistic solutions are our aim. That is the company motto. And it's always years ahead of when people were requiring environmental elements in the work. I felt that it was necessary to engage with the total environment and to look at what was going to happen down line. Because, for instance, I was the first geologist, engineering geologist at Sasol II, and we saw what was going on there in terms of the environmental impact. And when I went to my company subsequently, we approached Sasol and said, you know, you've got environmental issues to face. They told me, we will never have any pollution from this plant. And anybody today who sits in Joburg when the wind is blowing in the wrong direction or in the standard direction can vouch for the fact that it's not the truth.
And our last guest tonight is Dr. Humphrey Lawrence Mbandeni Mate, who, in the words of a very old friend, Dave Hammond, who worked with Humphrey on the Goldridge project, is such a gentleman and thoroughly nice guy. And I can vouch for that because when I started working with Humphrey on Kalgold, which is, of course, what the Goldridge project became, that is what I experienced as well. So, Humphrey, I've been chatting to some of our old colleagues, and they've been giving us a little bit of, like, history. But why don't you tell us about those days of Goldridge and Shell and when you lived in the porter cabin behind the office?
Yeah, those were the days, Nolene. I must say that Shell gave me a huge opportunity, which I never got from any other company. When I joined Shell, I was called a supernumerary geologist. And the MD had to come and had to call me and explain what a supernumerary geologist is. But I think that was really great for me. I spent a few days at Shell House, which is now called Shell House, and then I went to Mafeking. And I worked with Kerrion there and worked on the Goldridge project. It was a great discovery. The way we discovered it, soil sampling, you'll know in that area doesn't work because of the calcrete cover. You can map the banded iron formations, but you can't take any soil samples. So we used to take 5 kilogram soil samples and send them to Australia for bulk cyanide leach. And that's how we actually discovered Goldridge, in terms of the soil samples, and the measurements were in PPBs, not PPMs. And then, of course, I was lucky that I was the first geologist that drilled the discovery hole, and I had a very great team there. And then, of course, you joined us when we were starting mining. I'm one of the few geologists that start a project from exploration right up to mining. And I remember those days when we used to fly from Joburg to Kalgold. I'd spend a week at Kalgold and then Fridays fly back home. It was really a great experience. And then, of course, when Genco made that unsolicited bid to acquire Billiton and, of course, Shell Minerals Division, Shell said, well, you are not going anywhere. You are staying here. At that time, it was a great thing to have a black person among your team. And then Shell said, "We are staying here." Jenko said, "No, he's coming this side." And they were busy fighting over me. And then Von Armstrong came with his company called Aurora Exploration at the time, which was part of Westrand Cons that Adam had bought.
Yeah.
And Von said to me, "Look, we don't understand this project. You've just sold it to us, but I think we need you this side." And they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. But it was really the great respect that I got from those executives. Adam Fleming, Ted Grobitsky, Von Armstrong, and Jeff Mowat, who was the finance person. So those were the four people that were running Westrand Cons and Aurora Exploration, and I was the fifth chief geologist at the time. And I think my career followed exactly what I had once thought about when I was growing up, moving from chief geologist, consulting geologist, and then eventually executive director or COO of a company.
So Ted actually was telling me about that whole story with you and Shell and how they'd offered you this this course and pathway to become one of their management. And Ted said, well, Humphrey decided that he's a geologist, he's going to stay a geologist with his Shell team. Instead of becoming an international professional executive, swanning around from country to country and from assignment to assignment. And Ted's words were, "You're a true geologist, and any young geologist should be proud to follow in your footsteps." And I agree, because since I met Humphrey, you know, in those days, we worked for a junior company, I guess, and there was no mentorship program. We'd never know what mentorship was, but Humphrey was my mentor. From the first day I started with that company right through to now, Numzang's been my mentor. And every January, we go, "This year we're going to get rich."
Indeed. We used to say that. Instead, we made Kalgold rich, you know.
We made Kalgold rich. And then we found Kalplats.
Yes, that's right. And I remember those days. I was living in Bedford View now. So I would probably drive to the Murchison Range because we had a joint venture with Metorex. And I used to stay at Cons Match, and I would spend 3 days on the Murchison Range mapping and getting the teams to do soil sampling. And then I'll drive back and drive to Stella, where we had that project.
Yeah.
And we found platinum there.
We did.
So that was the kind of life I was living. It was really great. I wasn't seeing my family, but you know, geology-wise, I was learning a lot.
To add to that, not only is Dr. Mate Nolin's mentor, he's also my mentor. And on top of that, he still continues to participate in the GSSA mentorship program as well. So,
as does James.
Yes. The gentlemen around here are all in some ways involved in mentorship. Now, James, we'll come back to you. And Dr. Mate mentioned discovery holes and finding deposits. Now, you've got a lot of credentials in your CV. Can you tell us some of the interesting finds you've had and highlights specifically in your career?
I'd just like to maybe comment on two of them. One of them kind of builds on the story which I mentioned in my kind of introduction. And the diamonds that we were jigging came from became the Klipspringer diamond mine. And right next door to the Klipspringer diamond mine is the Maasfontein diamond mine, which had the reputation of having the fastest ever payback of any diamond mine, any mine in the world, of 3.5 days.
What?
And it was extraordinary. It was, Humphrey was talking about being involved from almost cradle to grave of this mine, and one was involved with the discovery, one was involved with the joint venture negotiations coming back. And I remember a discussion when I was then at that point general manager for exploration geology, that there was a discussion about whether we should actually define a resource for it. And I wasn't working in the resource department, but working in the geology department with a bit of a commercial background. And the head of resources, resource management, and myself were summoned by the managing director to argue our respective cases. And the head of resources, very good. You know, we must have an inferred resource. We must have an indicated resource. We must do this to get a bankable that, blah, 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 blah. And then the managing director turned around and said to me, well, what do you think? And I said, well, it's either going to have, you know, a 3 or 4 week payback at most. So do we really need to worry about this? And he said, no, build a mine. So we did, and it had a 3.5 day payback, and it was self-funded. And I think the other story I'd like to share with you, and I've been very blessed to be involved in several discoveries, is the rediscovery of AK6 or Karowe in Botswana. This was a kimberlite that was discovered by De Beers in the late '60s. And like many exploration projects, with the lens of new technology and new thinking, geological thinking about different geological models, things are different. And people will say the same, I'm sure, in 20 years' time, 50 years' time, and 100 years' time. And we had a very good look, and we at that time was a joint venture between De Beers and African Diamonds, and I was the managing director of African Diamonds. And we realized that the kimberlite was a lot bigger, and it was a lot higher grade, and it was certainly worth having a real look at it. And the story I want to briefly share you about this is that we argued that the project was highly commercial. De Beers argued that it was not commercial, that it was sub-commercial. And African Diamonds only had their share in the AK6 deposit. So this was a company maker or breaker for us. And I remember a board meeting for those who've been to Botswana at the top of the Grand Palm very, very late at night, just before the Botswana Resource Sector Conference, where I was up straight after the minister in the following morning. And my board was on my case that we had to actually stop De Beers applying for a retention license because it was wrong. And I was so conflicted, and I was wrong to be conflicted at the time, because having such a wonderful history with De Beers and now being managing director of African Diamonds with different shareholders. And I didn't know what to do. And a very, very wise local manager, Ribson Kabanoi, called for a bathroom break. And he said, James, just come and have a little word with me. And I had such deep respect for the man. And he said to me, James, just remember that the company you worked for then at that time is a very different company. It's the same name, but a different company. We're behind whatever you want to have as Botswana. So you make the decision you want to do. So I went with the board decision. And the final part of the story for the moment, anyway, is the following morning at 7:45, I start my presentation. And at 8 o'clock, I'm halfway through my presentation. And I stop and say, I have to read the following press release. And there's like hushed silence. And I read the press release saying De Beers is launching a high court action. I mean, African Diamonds is launching a high court action against De Beers to prevent them putting it under a retention license. And the 300 or 400 delegates kind of exploded. I'd arranged this with the organizer. I had a quiet exit, so I didn't take questions and kind of went off. But the postscript to it is, African Diamonds shareholders made 25 times their money. AK6 is now the Lucara diamond mine, produced some of the most fabulous diamonds in the world. And although, like Humphrey said, you know, I didn't make anything out of it, but shareholders did. I think that's a lot of people like us. It's not just done well for shareholders, but actually very importantly, it's been a great employer. And payment of taxes for Botswana too as well. And witnessing that project almost from cradle to grave. But as one happens in junior companies, it's someone with a larger checkbook comes along and buys you out. So you can't necessarily see it all the way through. But that's life. You know, you're philosophical about it. You feel blessed that you've been part and parcel of developing something which people felt could not be developed, but is now kind of a flagship diamond mine in Botswana.
You're getting out one of the parties at its best.
And Ali, we'll jump back to you. I mean, I mentioned the Barker Coalfields of Southern Africa maps, which I've been seeing ever since I started. And I think the first edition for the coal one was 1986, if I'm not mistaken. But what are some of the highlights in your career? I mean, apart from that, did you make any shareholders money like the other two gentlemen?
Oh, tough question.
Yeah. Well, the maps, let me give you a little background. The maps evolved from my work in doing exploration for coal exploration in South Africa. And I started to realize that there was a lot of information out there which I was gathering. And I felt that a lot of people didn't know where these mines were. So at one stage, I went to my friend Peter King, who I was working with. He was ex-CSI, Mintec, not the Peter King who was the WITS person. And I said, Peter, do you know if someone would be interested in this coalfields map? And he said to me, well, you know, maybe, but most people know where these mines are. And I thought about it and I thought, you know, I had a hunch. So I went ahead and I started to compile the data that I had. And we got the basics of the main mines in the Witbank coalfield. And I published the first one. It was a very iffy compared with what it is now. But I was amazed that I took it to a mine manager and he said, oh, I didn't know that mine was where it is or next to me. Eventually I got hold of the TCOA and Mike Harris got on my side and we produced the first coalfields map for the TCOA, which was the first one that really got us going. And at one stage I had something like 12 subscribers in one edition. And we used to print about 1,600 maps at a time. Now we print 16, you know, 20, because the animal has changed. And I'm about to publish the final one, I think, which will be 2023. But it's taken a long time to get it out. Seriti was helpful, and so was Tungela. So it's been an important effort by a lot of people. What happened with those maps, and it's the platinum, it went from there to gold and then to platinum. We've only published one gold map because things don't change in the gold industry. The owners do, but the actual mine boundaries are almost exactly the same as they were 20 years ago. There have been new discoveries, but mainly within the boundaries of the existing mines. So that never got any support for a second edition, which I've always been sad about, but that's how it is. And then the platinum came along and someone said to me, what's platinum? In about 1998, 1997, no one really knew about the platinum mines. And I started putting them together and Kevin Cartoon was very supportive. And eventually I got hold of my friend Gordon at Anglo Platinum, and he and his colleagues gave it the support, and that was the first platinum map, which was supported largely by Anglo Platinum. And we've done several now. We're in our fifth edition. And but the point was that it was something other than my time. Mm. If I at one stage could pay quite a lot of my overheads by selling coal, platinum maps and coal maps and stuff, and that was why I did it. And I also feel that information is empowerment. And there were a lot of people who I believe in the schools, and that was my big drive, is to get these into the schools. I was Laboa's minerals advisor for a year or two until I was told to leave because I said the wrong thing. my predecessor had been banned to the magisterial district of Cape Town. So when I was offered the job, I went to Dr. Patudi and I said, I'm working entirely for you and only for you. And he agreed to that, and that gave me a level of protection. But eventually, when I suggested that they shouldn't tax the mineral rights, because I had Vaughan Armstrong phoning me from Rio Tinto saying, Oliver, can't you find me even one small project on the Eastern Limb? And I said, yeah, but you know, the whole place is owned by the corporation, being about they took it on, and I got a phone call the following Monday morning from the consulting geologist of JCI saying, what the hell are you talking about? And then I got a letter the following week to say, please just stay in Joburg. You can have your job, but just stay in Joburg. So that was after 2 years. But one of our big things was that we had an outreach program. And I've still got a little box of Laboa's minerals, which I put in a little box. And I got a car for my friend Malaleki, who was a graduate from Tshwane. And he would then we produce maps, big maps of the wall maps of the mineral resources of Laboa. And he would go out to the schools and he would talk to them and he would hand out these little boxes of minerals, which unfortunately also had asbestos in them. But, you know, we don't talk about that. Asbestos doesn't exist anymore. You know, it doesn't exist. It doesn't even get mentioned in the mineral resources, strangely enough. And he then went out and we had this outreach. He would go to, they would have local derbies and conferences, but they would have open-air events. And he would go along and talk to the kids and he would get the schools and we would go, you know. And that was very good until I said, well, now you should get a position from the Council for Geoscience because on the Geological Survey at the time. Because here you are, Laboa has set up this mineral division, but you know you need to have some connection directly with the Geological Survey. You must be employed by the Geological Survey. Now we're talking about 1983-84. I went to see the Director General, the Director of the Geological Survey at the time, and I said, "Listen, we've got this young man. He's employed by the Laboa government, and he's a geologist, and he's doing outreach, and he's doing exploration work, and I've got projects for him to look at all sorts of things in Laboa. Please, can you employ him as a member of the Geological Survey?" He said, "We don't have a position for him." They could not create a position for this person because he was black and because he was not in the system. So that really, it was one of the, you know, so I was a bit of a betucha.
There's been a lot of that with people like me, Oliver.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to say is your coal map was great for me because I was always a geologist on the hard rock side. Mm. And when I joined AS Israel, of course, it was AS Israel coal. I didn't know anything about coal. Mm. So that book helped me a lot. Mm. And that's where Sfiso and I were working, because I had to look after Matla, New Clydesdale, Arnott, and Lisa at the time. So, yeah, that coal map book was great.
Books on the Wall was a name that was coined by Spike McCarthy at a presentation that I made of the maps one year at the venue there. He said, he gave a talk and he said, "This is a book on the wall." And that's how I coined the name for the company.
The public. Mm-hmm.
Humphrey, we did some work in Peru, but you also had issues there, didn't you, because of your skin color?
No, not really. No, not in Peru. No, Peru was great.
Oh, wasn't it the nightclub that they wouldn't let you in?
No, we went into some nightclub with Sandy. You remember Sandy?
I remember Sandy.
I was actually a celebrity there.
You were.
These Spanish people seeing a black person, you know, it was great for them. No, they really treated me very well. You know, where I had a biggest challenge with that was when I was working for Shell. After Goldrich, I was when was it? Gavin Whitfield asked me to go and do some work in the bushveld. That was round about 94, but just before the elections. And Dave Moore was working on that project, you know, and they were finding it difficult to work there. So I said to Gavin, why are you sending me? I mean, if Dave Moore was suffering, I'll suffer more, you know. But I think one of the things that young geologists must learn is that you must always have a positive attitude with people and try and learn the language of people. You know, having grown up in Soweto, and we grew up speaking what we call Tsotsitaal, which is a mixture of Afrikaans and everything else. That made things much better for me in the bushveld, in the Limpopo, because I could approach farmers and speak in my broken Afrikaans, and I would get access to their area, areas that Dave Moore couldn't get access to. And when I had finished there at Shell, they said, how did you do this? You know, and I said, well, you know, I was just an ordinary person going with these farmers with great respect. There's only one farmer that said, I don't want to see a black person there. But funny enough, because he was based in Pretoria and he had a manager there, I went to his manager anyway and said to him, you know, I'd like to do a little bit of work here. I tried to call your boss in Pretoria and I couldn't get him. But, you know, I'll be here 2 days, 3 days, I'll be gone. And he said, no, great, come in. So I did the work there as well. So, yeah, look, I think with a good attitude, you can soften the hearts of people. And luckily for me, that's what it has been throughout my career, you know. Even if I experience a lot of negativity, just my attitude to people always made things much better for me. And that was what I learned from my dad, who said, you know, in those days, remember, we couldn't even go to libraries or anything like that. But we had a library in Orlando East, and my dad said, you know, you may experience apartheid, but the libraries are open. Go to the library and learn. And that's what I've done all along. I spoke of Vaughan, by the way. Vaughan, when I was at Aurora and Western Cons, I only had an MSc, and I wanted to do an MBA. And Vaughan said to me, finish your doctorate. And I was glad that I listened to him, because he said, finish your doctorate and you'll see what difference it will make in your life. And I think it has made a great difference for me.
So talking about Vaughan and a good attitude, when I was working at Culgold, I ended up on the wrong farm. And the farmer came and he was like, well, what are you doing on my farm? Luckily, I could speak a little bit of Afrikaans. And as a girl, it always helps to cry. So I managed to soften him up, but he did phone Vaughan. And Vaughan was just like, yo, these young girls.
He once said to me when I was doing some work for him up in the Limpopo Valley, and I brought back my drawings and my maps, and I'd been working on my own, and I had a draftsman and thing. He said, and I said, okay, will you hand this? Are you going to hand this to the draftsman? He says, no, Oliver, you're going to draw it up, because if you can't interpret what's there, no one else is, and you're going to see the mistakes. And I always remember that. He was a wise guy.
Vaughan used to make us color in our maps and sections on a Friday afternoon. And to this day, Friday afternoons for me is coloring in day.
Yeah, but Vaughan was great.
Yeah.
You guys should know that I don't drink, you know. And of course, on some Fridays we used to, I thought of it when I was here in Randburg. We were in one of the areas, all of us, you know, and went in and ordered an orange juice for me. And he said they must put in gin or something.
Oh, I remember.
And of course, I just smelled it and I said, no, this, and Vaughan was so angry. Yeah, I mean, it was just a joke, but Vaughan was so angry. But Vaughan was my protector. You know, he was great for me. He was excellent. Yeah.
He was a good manager. I think that was why he did well. Yeah.
And James was talking about diamonds. I must tell you this story. You know, I'm very lucky. I've worked in gold, I've worked in diamonds, I've worked in coal, I've worked in heavy minerals.
Platinum.
I've worked in platinum. And I've sold a project, which was Cow Gold, and I also sold a heavy minerals project when I was at Shell for ISCO, which ended up being the KZN Sands project. Of course, I went back there again when I was at Exaro. But when I was with Trenta Resources, some guys from Zimbabwe approached us and said, Robert Mugabe has given a tenement to disabled war heroes. They were called Zimbabwe Disabled War Liberation Heroes. That's what they were called. I think Mugabe was feeling, excuse me, very sorry for these guys. I mean, they were crippled, they were very poor, and all of that. And he then gave this tenement to them and said, get somebody to do this for you. That's the only thing I can do. But I need the profile of those people. So, of course, we gave them the Trenta Resources profile. He looked at it, and I think they got other profiles. And he said, these are the guys that must do the work for you. So Eric and I went to Marange to go and do this exploration for these guys. I think we spent about 2 or 3 weeks there, you know, mapping the area in the tenement. And then, of course, I just picked up diamonds on the ground. You just pick them there. If you know the history of Marange, it was found by some Australian guy because he saw young boys with catapults. And these young boys were saying, you know, these stones are good at killing birds. So these guys had a number of diamonds with them, and they were killing birds with them. They didn't know they were diamonds. You know? So, I mean, we did this mapping for these guys. And, of course, as I said, I picked up a few diamonds. What was interesting, when we were doing the mapping there, we were escorted by one person from the military, one person from the police, one person from intelligence. And these guys were not talking to one another. You know, we could talk to them, Eric and I, but they were not talking. Because I think there are Chinese walls in these things. So I picked up some of these stones, and I could see it's a diamond in this sort of conglomerate rock of theirs. So I said to the intelligence guy, because he looked a little bit brighter, these other guys. So I said, you know, I need to take these rocks and go and cut sections in Johannesburg so that I can have it. He said, no, excellent, you can take that. So I came back with diamonds here. But the story is we found diamonds. We spent money doing this at Trenta Resources, and we found diamonds in this tenement. And then we wrote a very good report. And what happened then, ZMDC, I think it's called, Zimbabwe Mineral Development Corporation, they took that tenement and said, the government needs to make money. So, you know, the poor disabled people never got that. They came back to me later on, and I said, look, guys, I've lost over $1.5 million doing work for you, and I never recovered the money. So there's nothing else I can do. But if you know the story of Marange, I don't know whether you know it.
I do know it. And in fact, I think it's one of the only sites I've been to where I was in tears. You talk about being in tears. Men can also be in tears. But knowing and understanding the history and having been back there many times, both with my De Beers hat and my junior hat, and seeing that the huge potential that area has to uplift society in that area, and looking at the environmental destruction, it just brings me to tears where an organized mining company, and I think I'll leave it at organized. It doesn't have to be anything more than that. But an organized company with good disclosures attached to it could almost make that, dare I say, like the Debswana joint venture in Botswana, where you could actually really exercise something for the good of the country and the good of all the different stakeholders. It's a fascinating area geologically.
It is.
I don't think they're ever going to find the origin of the metamorphosed diamonds, but every time I walk back there, and I walk back there, I think in December last year again, for about the fourth time, I see the massive potential is there.
It's still there.
But sadly that in Zimbabwe, diamonds are only allowed to be run by four different companies. Alrosa being the Russian company, and Botswana Diamonds can't deal with Russian companies. Obviously, we have in the past. The Chinese who are mining there. And in fact,
And the generals.
I'm going to get on to the other generals. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. and then Rio Tinto. But I made actually an offer to the Minister of Mines in Zimbabwe that can James Campbell in his personal capacity go and mine the Chinese dumps. And he said, why are you making such an absurd kind of a suggestion? I said that, you know, I come from a history of over 20 years at De Beers and I've been very fortunate of being in diamonds all of my life. And yeah. I understand being very fortunate of being in many other elements. And I think we're all very blessed to be where we are at the moment. But I said, this is their only diamond mine. And I look at their mining practices, their geological control, their metallurgical control. And you and I and my company and everybody else could make a lot more money and save the environment by
environmental degradation that you find there.
Yes. So it's a... I believe Zimbabwe is highly prospective, and what our investors look at is three very simple things. It's prospectivity, which is geology.
Yeah.
And if you haven't got the first, then you don't even go to numbers two and three.
Yeah.
Number two is political risk, typically articulated by the Fraser Institute study or whatever other study you actually want to actually look at. And thirdly is the track record. Have you found mines? Not have you found deposits, but actually have you found mines which have actually made money? And we believe Zimbabwe's got the prospectivity in spades, not just for diamonds, but for many other things.
Yeah.
Lithium, coal, copper, platinum group metals, you name it. But sadly, it ranks quite low.
Yeah.
To be polite on the Fraser Institute study. And I would love, by the way, just as a matter of record, before I hang up my geological boots, I would love to find a diamond mine in Zimbabwe.
In Zimbabwe.
That's absolutely right. Love to do that.
Vaughan and I actually went to the Penalonga, the greenstones there to do some work. I think Ted also joined us. But it also fizzled away.
It was gold.
It was gold,
Like Amalia.
Like Amalia, yes.
I was quite fortunate in one of my iterations as a geologist. I was approached by Platinum Australia, a little small company, and asked to map and find targets for them to do open cast mining. They had this low energy process. They looked at this as a potential to, or use it in a potential to approach small open cast operations all the way around the outcrop of the bushveld. So we mapped the entire bushveld from Northam all the way through to Amalia, the northernmost part of the bushveld. And eventually they found one little window of opportunity. But that was a fascinating experience to see how much of that geology was at that stage not even looked at as an open cast. And then within 10 years, just about every single square inch of that outcrop has been mined by various small companies. Yeah, we were involved in some very interesting early phases of that.
Some great discoveries there.
Oh, and you see, I didn't pass on. I didn't make the money, but
just for the record,
it was called the Panton process. The actual procedure, the process that they were used.
But it's making a difference, Dr. Monty, in, you know, the environment where you're working in, and you see the development and change, right? I'm sure that's fulfilling.
No, I just wanted to tag on what Oliver had said about drilling and tell you my story of how I got into drilling. I was working in a mine called Giant Reefs, and we later called it Fumani Gold Mine. And the aim was really to drill some boreholes and see whether we can't open the mine. We had a driller that was drilling for us. I won't call the name. and he used to go away and go and sleep, you know. I mean, that area in terms of the weather, it's highly humid and very hot. Mm. You know, if you are not used to it, it's really hostile. And he used to go away and go and rest in his caravan. And because I was a very enthusiastic young geologist, I wanted the core to come out, you know. So I would go and drill with the guys whilst he's asleep, do the drilling myself and get the core because I needed the core. And at that time when there was nothing like a core splitter, you remember that, mm-hmm. or a core saw. So I used to hit the core with a hammer and split it. You know, there was a little machine you hit with a hammer, and you've got two pieces. One piece you send for analysis, and the other one you keep there. You know, so that's how I got into drilling, just helping this driller.
Oh, as a CP, I'm not sure about that.
Representativity bias.
If I could build on Humphrey's story about drilling, you know, people often ask me, now, why are you still going out to drilling sites and spending time with the drillers? Now, you're old. And I said, don't talk to me about being old. Why is it so important that you go there? And in the diamond world, it's slightly different. Mm. Now, what we've got to ensure is that when we do our drilling, particularly for grade assessment purposes, that we don't break diamonds. Mm. And the minute you turn your back on a driller, the driller will go hammer for tongs because he's being paid a rand or a dollar per meter, and it will break diamonds. And I know of so many projects which will remain unnamed where the drillers did their work and the samples are processed and they're lovely CPRs and all those kind of good things around them, but the diamonds are broken and you can't value them, and therefore the resource is not worth the salt it is. So I often encourage the younger geologists, it doesn't matter whether you're 20, 30, 40, 50 something, you go back and you sit on the rig and you just make sure that, yes, you by all means have the parameters all written down, but nothing beats just sitting on the rig, watching the kimberlite come up, sieving the kimberlite, doing very basic things like particle size analysis and all those kind of things, all the way through to sieving of the diamonds. And I said, those disciplines actually never change.
Yeah.
So, James, I totally agree with you, and I always tell geologists, no matter what the age, to go out to the rig and understand what's happening. I was on a project in Zambia, and the project manager was complaining about their accuracy. So I said, well, let's have a look at it. Let's go to the rig and have a look at what you're using and why you're not getting accurate readings. No, we'll bring it to you. Anyhow, so the tool arrives in the office, lovely air-conditioned office, open it up, it is brand spanking new. The plastic hasn't even been taken off the tool. So I said, so what are you using for your mark? Oh, no, they're using a spear. The project had been running for 6 months. The geologist did not know what they were using for their core orientation mark.
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid you shouldn't, as a geologist, whether you're a CEO running a junior company whose job is to find and discover new deposits, you must never lose sight of your field work. I would like to share a very brief story of I was hosting I know some of us have said unnamed. I was hosting the WITS fourth year students about 3 years ago, and I took them down to the Maasfontein pit, and they needed to have a look at a fresh exposure of kimberlite, which is at the bottom of the pit. And it's one of those very hot days, about 40 degrees, and it's a steep pit going in and out. So it was hot and sweaty work. And at the end of the kind of morning's field session, a couple of the ladies came up to me and said, Mr. Campbell, I hope we're not going to be rude, but we'd like to ask you a question. I said, no, you can be as rude as you want to be. It's really not a problem. But when we're your age, we don't want to be in the field. And I looked at them in horror and I said, well, You're graduating in an honours degree in geology. What do you want to do? Oh, we want to be consultants. And I said, okay, do you think someone like me will use someone like you as a consultant? And they look at me, we don't know. I said, no. No, frankly not. I need to have specialists in areas of expertise who know more about this stuff than I do. Oh, so what do you suggest? I said, I know this is going to sound terribly ageist, but it's meant to be what it's meant to be, that you should spend at least 10 years in the field or on a mine site learning field craft and doing the work. Oh, gosh. I said, how do you think investors in exploration, which come from Europe, sadly, that's the way it is, chiefly the UK and Ireland, they trust me with their money because they know that I'm in the field looking after their money and I have a detailed knowledge and interest of the project. They're not going to fund a consultant because they don't have skin in the game and they don't have knowledge. So I suggest you find yourself a good project. It doesn't matter who it's with, but some really good field project. Learn field craft, but never let it go. By all means, add on things. And I decided, Humphrey, to take the MBA route and go the kind of commercial route on top of doing my geology degree as well. And it's worked for me. It doesn't matter, but do it later in life. I wrote my master's thesis in a tent in Botswana whilst building the first diamond mine at Lorala. I didn't, and I shared this story with people. You mean in a tent? I said, yes, I had a little candle and a gas light when it was good. The Anglo-American Information Services would be sending me papers up there, and I would write. And then when I got home on the odd weekend, I would kind of put it into a computer and type it up. And you know, I look at the thesis now, and I'm very proud still, 20 years later, of the work. But I didn't have technology. And it was hard work because I was building a mine and engaging with communities, finding water, building a little township, making sure the plant worked. It was quite a thing. I said, so please, if you're in this profession, whether you end up being a consulting geologist or a chief executive, doesn't matter. Never lose those disciplines which you engage in the first part of your life.
Yeah. But you need them as the basis to make those decisions.
Absolutely.
You can't learn it from a book.
No, you can't. And that's what I was kind of drive through to it. And I frequently post on Twitter and LinkedIn and these things of being in the field. And it is trying to encourage youngsters that whether you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, and going all the way up, that you must continue those disciplines because it means that you've got control over what you're actually doing. And really importantly, your investors actually trust you. Because you're doing the hard yards yourself.
Speaking of the hard yards and the field craft and the field cred, I mean, you mentioned the enthusiasm that you still have, which impresses me, right? Till this day, you mentioned you're always posting on LinkedIn. And I told you earlier, I mean, it's you're making geology look cool again, especially appealing to the youngsters, right? And you're talking about breaking diamonds. You also have like a stretching routine that you have. You've got a setup with your field vehicle with showers and but on a serious note, I mean, that goes with like the prep and the seriousness and being there on the ground.
Absolutely, Safisa, and I'd like to kind of take up where Humphrey was as well. It's all well and good for the CEO to go into a nearby lodge and have the comfort of the warmth and the comfort of the lodge itself. But you know, every now and again, more often than not, you've actually got to be on site and camp with the people and engage with the people and experience what the people are feeling at the time. And where I had a very great mentor called Alex Van Sale and Bill McKechnie in my early career. And one of the things they said to me was that it doesn't matter whether you like it or not. You have to learn the field craft, and we've discussed that. But as important, you've got to feel what it's like to live in the field day in, day out, and experience the hardships which the people actually experience. Because then you'll be able to engage through them day in and day out. And yes, this week it was tough. You know, we're experiencing a bit of a cold wave at the moment in South Africa, and there was one showering outside in 5 degrees centigrade. and trying to make your cup of coffee while the wind was blowing. But at the main, you know, then you gathered around the fire and you had a nice briar and a couple of drinks. And we had a fantastic discussion on how the plant is working and, you know, where the diamonds possibly are going and what we need to do to improve the plant. But it's so important to maintain that. because it gives you that connection with your employees, and also very, very importantly, actually connection with the communities as well. Because so often when, you know, companies engage with communities, they send a consultant or an officer who is supposed to engage with communities. But what communities mostly want to do is actually engage with the chief executive, the guy who makes the decision, and spend time with that person, you know, just around a table in the middle of the bush, having a cup of tea, a glass of beer, it doesn't matter what it is, just talking person to person about normal life, normal things, and about how you can actually work together. And if you're sitting behind a desk or you have a Zoom call over it, you're just not going to achieve that kind of thing, rather than saying, no, we've got plenty of time, we can sit here this afternoon and do it. Yes, means I might have to work a bit longer in night and a bit more the next day and maybe add another day, but it's absolutely vital, because, you know, they are the landowners of the area. And one must have that respect that, you know, they will be there long after you've gone and long after the mine has actually gone.
Yeah, and it gets you to respect them and also respect your people that are at the rig that you are with. Nolene will tell you, we used to rotate going to the rig because Vaughn insisted there has to be a geologist at the rig. And that was the right thing to do.
You know, in engineering geology, there's been a very significant move away from geologists actually being on the rigs for many exploration work. And I'm specifically talking about dolomite. It's very common for consultants, and we're engineering geologists are all consultants because they're not employed in mining companies very much, to send out a drill, identify a series of holes and leave the drill to drill the holes. And then they get bags of sample, which they take back to the office, and then they profile them at the office. And I've lost many jobs because I don't do that. I make sure that when I was doing it, I was on the site. I spent the time on the site. I priced that into my proposals. And now, I mean, this last 2 weeks, I've had this young Flavius Zulu on the site, watching the struggles of this one rig and then forcing them to get another rig onto the site and seeing how they battled, jammed the rigs, jammed the core, crushed the core, and then getting a new rig in, which came in from another contractor, which drilled 100% core in the same rocks. And he's now been able to see the two situations and understand what's going on, because we need to design a township on top of here.
Yeah.
We need to know where the holes are, where the soft material is, and the cavities, because it's on an old mine. So it's unfortunately, the attitude is you've got to cut the costs, and the only way you can cut the cost is keeping your staff out of the field for 6 or 8 hours a day. And that is counteractive or counterintuitive.
If I could just add on to that, my argument when people come to me about that is that your costs will actually come back and bite you at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, front end load, I hate that expression. I think it comes from the consulting industry or something like that. But whatever it is, it's a very, very good expression. Put a huge amount of intellectual input in at the very beginning and get the design right. And the rest is almost process. You can get the thing done actually after it. So, I've seen many juniors and majors where they have stripped out, you know, they've maybe engaged with management consultants and come in and stripped out very senior technical people with deep experience. And they've gone on and thought, no, we've saved a lot of money, but come along the next large mine, it costs a lot more money and it takes a lot longer. Whereas actually, if one had actually front end loaded it with that deep technical experience, you would have been able to avoid those kind of larger costs at the end of the day. So, and thankfully, my group actually understands that kind of concept. And I think one of the great challenges I have in my particular world in the diamond industry is that I think I'm the last active junior diamond CEO in the region, and trying to hand over those kind of skills in terms of fieldwork, so many brilliant geologists out there, but also being able to kind of package it up and market it and get money behind the thing is it's a massive challenge. And I worry
it takes time.
About legacy. I worry about legacy, that where are we going to be in diamonds in 50 years' time or 20 years' time, because we haven't necessarily been able to develop the next kind of cadre. I don't mean that in the political sense. I'm sure you understand.
We won't call you comrade.
You know, of diamond explorationists, because it's a big worry.
Yeah.
But is it just diamonds?
It's not diamonds only.
It's everywhere.
I told you I'm going to Swaziland next week.
Yeah.
I still do the work.
Sorry, Eswatini.
Eswatini, yes. Yeah.
We've been interested in Eswatini for a while now, but it is very complicated. So I wish you the best of luck.
No, I've been there several times. We are drilling now. But, you know, for interest sake, the Council for Geoscience has done a high-resolution aeromag and radiometrics, and they've identified kimberlite pipes.
Hmm. Ah, here's a good bit of marketing.
not for me. I'm not there anymore.
But, I mean, on a serious note, as you mentioned, you know, one day James can be, you know, out there in the field. One day he's going to sell the project in London in suits. You know, it's always an interesting, you know, post that he has. We've segued now into, you know, like advice for youngsters, but I just want to come in here and tell a story and a few things that I've learned personally myself, right? One of which Dr. Mate mentioned earlier around adapting and the cultural intelligence, learning languages, right? Which has put me in good stead. I was also born in Soweto, so I managed to understand a handful of languages, including Afrikaans, going to the Northern Cape. But going to Saudi as well, I had that aptitude to learn languages very quickly. And, you know, I created good rapport with people even in Saudi and so forth. That was the first one. The second one, and Dr. Matu will know this, it's another mentor of mine. He's late, Ray Maloka. I met Dr. Matu at the same time with the late Ray Maloka.
He used to report to me.
Yes, exactly. And I reported to him. So, yes, they gave me my first job in geology, essentially, in my third year, just as I was about to do my honors, which was a very good experience. And I mean, I'm forever grateful for that, because part of that, we were driving, I think, to Arnott with, the late Ray. I think in my initial interview, I was a bit casual. I didn't polish it as much. And he brought that up as we were driving to Arnott. And he's like, you know, you must polish this, because that is the first contact or engagement you have with someone. Yes, you can have a good CV, you know, can speak well, but you make sure you get your story right. And that I'll never forget. And the other thing he said, and you mentioned, Dr. Mata, about writing reports, a good report. One of the things he said, take yourself and the craft seriously and write good reports. So when I finished, I was capturing data at ASIZO, as you mentioned. I write a very good report. I interpreted and nice conclusions, and that quite impressed me. But I'll never forget that discussion we had on that drive. So it goes back to the question, you know, what you would tell a newly graduated Sifiso or yourself in this day and age. I know we've touched on some aspects, but what would you tell a newly graduated self? Let's start with James.
I think the first thing, and we've said many of these things, and maybe to summarize it from my own perspective, is really embrace your early career in the field. Learn field craft and keep it as one of your core disciplines for the rest of your life. Secondly, engage with the people and the communities around you. Thirdly, despite all the kind of challenging environment that we have around us, remain positive, because after all, there's no such thing as a successful negative explorer. Just remain positive. I think it's really crucial. And the final thing is, I would say, and I'm maybe slightly guilty of not doing so much of this in my own career, is that, yes, have a career plan. And I think it's really important to have a plan. But at the same time, be opportunistic. So if good opportunities come your way, have a think about them, deliberate them, because you don't know everything when you start out in life when you're 21, and take them or not. So Fiso, those would be kind of my four things.
Humphrey?
Well, mine really would be language. Language is very important. Fiso spoke about writing a report. Writing a report is really the final part of your observations and the work that you do in the field. And your attitude has to be the right attitude to say, this is the rock I see. Describe that rock. And if you don't have the language, it's not going to be easy to do that. And I know many scientists don't think that they should study even, you know, preliminary English or something like that. Because they say, well, I'm doing mathematics and this. But you say mathematics is a language as well. If you don't understand the language, you're not going to be able to solve the problems. So I always encourage by the way, I had 10 years of university lecturing. That was the days when I couldn't get a job. And that's why I said Shell was the savior for me, because I joined Shell in 89. I had joined the university in 79. University of Zululand.
Oh, in Zululand.
I spent exactly 10 years at the university. I joined on the 1st of July, left on the 30th of June, 10 years later. Mm. But I used to encourage students to study English. Because I actually said any other language, as long as you can describe what you are seeing and describe it properly, it makes your report writing much easier. And, you know, when I did my MSc at Rhodes, Bob Mason was
Bob was a mentor of mine.
And Bob used to say to us, you've got to write simple English, you know. The cat sat on the mat. That's what he used to say, you know. The cat sat on the mat, full stop. Don't try and drag and say the cat sat on the mat and the mat was blue and you confuse yourself. Because a comma and a full stop is very important in whatever you write. Because your sentence can change if the comma is at the wrong place, you know. So I usually encourage students that they must learn the language, they must observe and note their observations. Because once you've noted your observations, it's easy to write a report. And in writing a report, be systematic. Have proper headings which will make people understand what you're doing. Sipo used to say to me, you know, you write reports. How do you get this? And I said, well, you know, it's simple. You speak English and try and be systematic in what you are trying to describe. So, Fiso, you're right. Writing a report is very important, and that's how it sells any project that you do on. I'm glad that James also was involved in working in a project and selling it. I was working on Gold Ridge at the time, and I was involved in selling it. And then I worked on the heavy minerals, and Gavin Whitfield, went to ISCO. And we sold this to ISCO, and I was involved in that. Those were the great learning experiences that I had at Shell, you know. Even though in the end they were fighting for me, which wasn't a good experience, but at least I learned a lot. So that's basically what you say to a student. But also what's important is they must always have the right attitude. If you have the right attitude with what you are doing, it makes things much easier. By the way, Kalgold still phones me about boreholes.
Data.
Yeah.
Yes.
They phone me about boreholes. There's a certain borehole. What was the grade there? And I'll tell them the grade because I never forget.
Yeah, you know? I get the phone calls.
But also the other thing which James also mentioned is have that relationship with the people that you work with and with the community. You would remember at Gold Ridge, Nolene, we had the team that was working in the Kraipan village, and they went to the wrong place to go and do the work there. And so we were hauled by the chief, and he said, well, come and explain, because the guys said, and they went to the wrong place. But when I was there, I didn't blame them. I couldn't blame them. You know, I said, I made a mistake. I looked at the map and I think I told them the wrong thing. and chief and community, I beg your pardon. And the chief said, what do we say when a man says he did it? You know, what else can you say? And the community said, no, all right, they can go free. You know, now you can come and do the work, you know. And I had great respect from those guys because they thought I was going to blame them. Mm. But I actually took the blame myself. And it made things simple, you know. So geologists, young geologists, that's the attitude they must have as well. When working with people and working with communities. But the important thing is document everything you do. Mm. Whatever is not documented, it never happened.
You're looking at you.
I could feel the stares. All of the above. I can say all of the above. One of the most important things that I learned was writing my master's degree. Up until then, I had a lot of self-doubt as what I was as a writer. We wrote little projects at university, but when I got to write my master's, it was a big master's. And I had to type it on a facet myself, like James did, but I wrote it out and then I typed it. And then my mother helped me type it. And then eventually when I had a job, I got a typist to type it up finally to make it look smart. But then I also redid it myself with the help of a kind secretary. But that taught me how to compile logic and thoughts. And I was very, very lucky to have Andy Button, Spike McCarthy, Rod Fripp, and another sedimentologist whose name I won't remember now. He was an American, worked at WITS, to guide me in the way in which I would prepare my thoughts. And as a result, when I came out of that process and I started working, I found it a lot easier to compile a report. And what I would say to any young geologist, and this young man that's working for me is just so phenomenal. He writes very nice reports, and he's fluent. And his mother and father were literally not educated, but he has produced the most remarkable capacity to go forward. I think that is probably in engineering geology, we have to sell every project that we do because we have to tell the developers that they can do what they want to do or why they can't do what they want to do. And so being able to make that argument and to present the data in a logical and understandable way, because engineering geology is the phase, but the face between the geology and the engineer. And we stand in between and we have to understand the geology and understand what the engineer wants or the township developer. So we have to have the language and the skill to put together the ideas that will allow them to understand what they can and can't do and to try and help the DMR to understand what they can and can't do. And that is a bridge that I still have to cross. But that is what I would say in addition to everything else that you've said. Reporting is key.
Yeah. I wonder if I could just add two things I've forgotten about, just very, very briefly. One is that your geologists who come out must be jack of all trades.
Yes.
You know, if they're going to a field site and the plumbing doesn't work, they've got to fix it. You know, I maybe draw the line at electrical work. But, you know, they've got to provide enough food if they're going into the Kalahari for a week. Now, there isn't necessarily an HR department or an IT department or these kind of things. So all of they must be multi-skilled in all of those kind of areas. And also something which worries me a little bit about geology graduates here in this country as well is they must have an understanding of the interfaces, as Olive was talking about, with geological engineering, with mining engineering, with metallurgy. I come from the Royal School of Mines where it was compulsory third year subjects in mining engineering, mineral economics, metallurgy and those kind of things. And I think if there is one kind of personal characteristics over and above what we've spoken about before, and it's something that I struggle to find exploration geologists having. Mine geologists, know, you can put to a penny, but getting a good exploration geologist, there's one defining criteria, and that is an intense curiosity.
Yeah.
Asking lots and lots of questions, yeah. Reading everything, walking the ground, and never being happy that they know everything about, because they never will, about anything. And it's that intense curiosity. And I still don't know how you teach it. You can encourage it. But that to me is such an important aspect.
Yeah. Speaking of teach, and so we're segueing into mentorship, we've touched on aspects thereof. The gentlemen here are all involved in some form of mentorship and have a lot of mentees under their wing. We know Oliver, he's in the Fellows Committee as well, but from the SAIG side, he's got a few people he's training up and mentoring. Dr. Mate from CGS has got a handful of mentees, and we hope once his tenure is done, he'll have a few on the GSSA mentorship. We've thrown him under the bus, but he has been involved in some of the workshops, the GSSA mentorship workshops. James obviously has also got a mentee, and he's training up people. One of the questions for James now that I got from a very reliable source, it's a presidential source at that, is that every project you are on, you manage to train juniors. So how do you make the time to do that?
I think it's something that you are trained to do, and something that, you know, came out of my De Beers background, is that you've always got to be able to train a successor. And, you know, if you can't train yourself out of a job, you're not actually doing your job properly. Yeah. I think that's the first part. And the second part is that we spoke about legacy a moment ago. What kind of legacy would you leave as a professional, leaving aside the kind of family legacy which we all hope to live? And the legacy that you can leave is by training people who are active participants in your space. So it's got to be something that you've been trained to do, and something that you are passionate about doing, that, you know, you can go and meet all of these people years later, and they still will reflect that they've had a good experience, and they have done very well. And often I take, you know, I have like a warm chuckle sometimes for some of the people I mentored many, many years ago, who are in very senior positions at the moment, and my bosses, which is the way it should be. That's exactly the way it should be. And you must be humble enough to actually do that.
Indeed.
Good. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Fossils by Firelight, and hope to see you again soon.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.